And I have close to $100 million of debt right now in commercial real estate. My definition of good debt is fixed, low interest that creates positive cash flow. It's that simple. I want as much of that as I can possibly get.
I actually went viral on TikTok.
Dave Ramsey's a freaking moron.
What I should have said is Dave Ramsey teaches to not use debt. And you can use debt in a very smart way. Good debt cash flows, it's fixed, it's long term, and it creates wealth.
This is not your average real estate podcast. When Sam Newell started his career, making his first six figures seemed like an impossible mountain to climb. Now, he's a seasoned real estate pro with over $350 million in real estate transactions so far. Sam's opening up his playbook and sharing the mic with his inner circle of experts, partners, and investors. Together, he'll dive deep into the biggest wins, losses, traumas, betrayals, and more that have made up the path to unparalleled success. It's time to get leveraged with Sam Newell.
All right, guys, welcome back to the podcast. I'm really excited to have Dave Allred here. And he's a good buddy of mine. We've been doing business, crossing paths for years now. And we actually worked at the same company for a while, Apex/Vivint. But man, I'm really excited to have you on. Really excited to hear about you teaching your kids to be financially literate, you climbing Mount Everest, you starting your fund, and some really cool stories. Four units to 62 units. We've got a lot to cover today. And more importantly, I think you're just a good dude. You're really smart, very organized and purposeful with your life. And anybody that knows you, I think, knows that. And I think that's what our listeners are going to benefit from today, is really hearing how you go about. I've seen your spreadsheets. You're extremely detail-oriented, right? And anyways, thank you for coming on the show, and I'm excited.
Thanks for having me on. Sam, it's an honor.
Absolutely. Well, let's get right into it, Dave. We've got a couple stories that we're talking beforehand that we can talk about. You and I have a similar background as far as real estate investing, you know, door-to-door sales. But also, you were telling me about your dad and how you're working really intentionally at being very present, a very purposeful father. You have four beautiful children, three daughters and a boy. And that's really important to me. And I know our listeners find it really important as well. And every day I'm with my kids, I'm trying to think about, oh yeah, what is my goal as a dad? Trying to teach them sports, honesty, integrity, serving others, financial literacy. So let's jump straight into, you ran away from home at 17. You did not have the support and intentionality at home and parenting that are optimal at, in any way. But take me back to 17 years old and what caused you to run away and create this amazing life of your own that's very different from where you grew up.
Sure. Happy to. So grew up in a small town, Manti, Utah, not far from here. And I'll preface this by saying I love my parents, and frankly, I think they did the very best they knew how to do, right? And so I'm really grateful for this. And I also feel like we get to choose how we frame things in our lives. And for me, this was, I just framed this as, hey, this is where I came from. This is the experience. And then how can I completely change that in the future and really reset the standard? But grew up in a very low income home. My dad worked two jobs. He really wasn't around too often. They got separated three times for about a year at a time. Trying to make things work. They always got back together for the kids, which I think the intention there was great. It was honorable, but in hindsight, it would have been better if they just would have called it, quits earlier on. But just a lot of dysfunction. And, when I was 15 years old, my older sister, she ran away, and I didn't know she was running away. I just heard some noise in the room next to mine. I went into her room, and she was pushing two white garbage bags out the window. And, I'm like, hey, what are you doing? She's like, hey, I'm running away. And I started crying and bawling, and I was like, hey, don't leave us here. And anyway, I ended up kind of helping her, push her stuff out the window. And I never saw her again for a few years.
Jeez.
Fast forward a few years, I was 17, and I had to get away from it. So I ran away at night and went over to Ephraim, about 7 miles away. And I found a little home there. I rented out for like $120 a month in rent.
Wow.
There's no way it would pass code today. I mean, literally the roof was falling in, there's bugs everywhere. We're living off of ramen noodles and fast food. And then my little brother, he decided to get emancipated. So he moved in with me as well. So
wow.
at that point, I'm, you know, looking out for my little brother and really just trying to survive, man. You know, working a night shift, making fiberglass poles, like flag poles, making, I think, like $6 an hour, right?
I got to pause you, Dave. Just sorry to interrupt. You and I have a crazy similar story. My brother was 14 and I heard crashing in the stairs and I'm like, I'm 5 years younger than him. I'm nine at the time and he's running away. Both parents are gone. Both parents are working. And it was bad. Like our family home was really bad. And I'm like, damn, like this sucks. He left me. I was nine and my sister was six and just gone. Like I've seen him probably four times since then. Really interesting. And so I kind of want to slow down a little bit. You're going to tell your story and everything, but you know, to have kids want to run away, that means it's rough, you know, and I love my parents too. I love my dad, love my mom. My mom lives here close and I take care of her and my dad's really tried to make up for lost time, but, it was rough. And so for kids to run away and you emancipated your brother, girlfriend, Betty Jo, she took care and guardianship of her little brother. Same as you. He was 16, not doing well in school and she took control of him. So it's really interesting. There's kids that are forced to grow up. I remember a very young age being forced to grow up and every podcast I do, I like to pick out a golden nugget and usually it takes me a while. And I think I've already found it. You said it, you can frame things however you want. You can be a victim. You can say, hey, I'm unsuccessful because of the way I was brought up. Or you can say, I'm successful because I wanted to be because of how I was brought up. And so you're 17, working night shift. I was a janitor, by the way, night shift at a young age, cleaning toilets. And by the way, we both went on mission to Peru. That's kind of cool. So we got a very parallel story here. Very interesting. But I really want to hit back on this throughout this podcast and remind our listeners, it's how you frame things. Because I'm very thankful for everything I've been through. Haven't seen my brother since 2007. He's got a rough life. My sister's not done so well, but she's doing amazing now. We've had a rough lives and it's all about how you frame things. And so moving forward, let's talk about that.
Yeah. You know, on that, I believe that most people have everybody has either a fixed mindset or a growth mindset, right? I think most people go through life with a fixed mindset, meaning it is what it is. You know, I am where I am because of no, my youth, my upbringing, my community, my skin color, my parent, you know, whatever else that we kind of blame other people for where we are in life. Yep. But the opposite of that is really having a growth mindset where we take full extreme ownership and full accountability for where we are today and realize that we literally are in the driver's seat, right? And we have full control over where we take our lives. Tony Robbins says, life happens for us, not to us. I've always loved that concept. And so, yeah. So, you know, I was, you know, 17, 18 years old, just struggling through this, trying to get through, trying to survive. And, you know, I remember there's a quote actually on a poster in my bedroom and it was one of my all time favorite athletes. And the quote, it says, if you do today what others won't, then tomorrow you can have what others can't. Jerry Rice.
Love that.
And that just kind of ingrained in my, like as a motto in my life. And I didn't know how I was going to break out of it. I just had this burning desire, like, hey, I'm going to do whatever it takes to reset the standard, change everything for me personally, my future family, to reset, you know, to reset everything, man. Like happiness, resolve trauma, success, you know, fulfillment, just really quality of life, lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so I had this commitment. I had no idea how I was going to do that, but I was just grinding at it. And then, you know, I was at Snow College and I was recruited to go out and knock doors in Chicago and it's supposed to be for 4 months. I knew it was going to be hard. Mm-hmm. But I saw it as an opportunity to get ahead and to kind of break out of that rut that I was in. Yep. And again, I knew it was going to be hard. I had no idea how hard it was actually going to be. It was one of the craziest, hardest things I've ever done in my life. Right. Yeah. 80% of the team quit. You know, somehow I made it through. My first month I sold 7 accounts, which is really, really bad. Was able to finish strong, sold 121 accounts, made $31,000, which that's for awesome. Me, even to this day, is the most meaningful money I've ever made in my life.
So in 2002, you made 31 grand in 4 months knocking doors.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Which is more than my parents ever made, right? And you know, and it was enough for me to really, you know.
So 31,000 was more than your parents had ever made?
Yeah.
That's crazy that I had that same experience. I got not my first door summer knocking doors, but I got to the point where I was making more than my parents, and it was a problem for them. How did your parents react, or were they in the picture at that point?
We weren't.
I didn't tell my parents for quite a while until that I was making good money, because there was some serious just issues there. And it did. It became a problem. So, but anyways, they weren't in the picture at that point.
Yep. And so that was enough confidence and a big enough win for me to come back the next year as a sales manager. You know, I made $156,000 that year, which was crazy to me.
That's awesome. Like
if you would have asked me as a kid, best case scenario, you know, what I might be able to make as an adult, I would have said $100,000.
Like, oh my God.
Like if everything worked out perfectly, right? And so to make that.
Have you heard my story of $100,000?
No.
Gosh, I'm going to keep interrupting, and I'm sorry, but this is weird.
Hey, it's your podcast.
I got into real estate. I bought my first flip in Provo, Utah while I was going to BYU doing summer sales. At that point, I was with Vess and those guys at Altera, Aptive. I forget what the name they had at that point, but you know, I got my real estate license doing my first flip. My realtor was like, you know, you could do this. If you can knock doors all summer, you can definitely sell real estate. And my goal was to someday somehow make $100,000 a year. I had been making about $50,000 a summer, 4 summers in a row, 50 to 60, knocking doors with Vivint and then with Aptiv. But my goal was $100,000 a year would be awesome. I thought that would just be the best. And that was my goal.
Yeah. And that win was, you know, really catapulted a 15-year leadership career. And I'll save all the details, but, you know, 121 sales teams in 41 states. And I learned so much about business. We had two huge liquidity events with Blackstone and Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. IPO and a merger. And I'm really grateful for it, man. Like yeah. I would love to have all my children go out and do a season of summer sales, because it teaches so much about grit, mindset, psychology, interpersonal development, leadership, salesmanship. Like you really learn so many soft skills from going through that process and really just doing hard things. You know, I kind of look back at my life right now, even in real estate, all stages of my life, I think I've always lived around this concept that if something scares you, you should do it, right? And we do hard things, then it's not scary anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've really just, my whole life has been that approach to business and personal life.
So how was, and I think that's great. And I've got a couple questions for you. My first area was Philly, and they dropped me off in South Philly. And I was scared. Like, you know, I'd already served a mission at this point. So I could do door to door and I could proselyte. I could knock doors, but there was a helicopter flying overhead, a police helicopter. And I went and asked a group of people like, what's going on? Oh, some guy just shot some cops with an AK. He's hiding in one of these vacant houses. I'm like, oh, do you want to buy an alarm system? And made a sale. But you know, I was scared and there was neighborhoods where I was pretty nervous, and Philly ended up being amazing. I'm curious how Chicago went and how, cause door knocking is tough. Like, lots of people can do it. There are lots of people with sales skills. That's not the problem. You made 7 sales your first month. Sales skills are a very small part of the problem when it comes door to door. It's mental toughness and just being able to get rejected, be bored and get rejected every day, all day for 4 months. That's the problem with summer sales is that's the tough part. Eventually you'll learn how to sell.
Yeah, but add on to that, that's about delayed gratification, right? Like most people now, especially nowadays, they want to see the instant result, instant dopamine hit from it.
Mm-hmm.
In door sales, there's a learning curve. You know, you get paid on a year-end commission or a back-end check.
Yep.
And so up front, you don't see a lot of that success. And, you know, it's very similar to the concept of the law of the harvest, right? You plant it, you toil it, you fertilize it. You don't actually see the results for quite a while.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing I'm trying to teach my kids right now is the concept or the principle of delayed gratification, because I feel like it's a lost art. And but to your point about the crime, so Chicago, you know, crime capital of the United States, coming from Manti, right? Like that was a fish out of water, man.
Yeah.
And about halfway through the summer, about half of our team had already quit. And actually one of the guys on the team got shot in the calf. Jeez. By a .22 caliber. So supposedly he was just walking down the street and somebody, you know, out of a window took a .22 caliber rifle, shot him in the calf. So after that happened, you know, another 30% of the team quit. So there's literally, I think it was like four or five guys left, you know, grinding out at the end of the summer. So to your point, mental, you know, talk about, you know, creating a tough mindset and having to just kind of get through it all. But, you know, you look back at that and again, super grateful for it, man, because you go through that and then you're just a lot more resilient and you know you can take on hard challenges. Even in real estate nowadays, like a lot of the times the very best deals and the most profitable deals have been the ones that have a lot of hair on them. They're challenging. They're scary, right? Mm-hmm. People don't know how to handle it. And so I think that's it's a great way to approach life. If it scares you, you should probably do it.
I love that. My three most profitable real estate deals, we were not first to the first offer. We were probably the third or fourth people to have it under contract. They were hairy, ugly. One was hotel. Two others were multifamily deals in Albuquerque and Florida that were just scary. And but we saw the value and we weren't afraid to go to work for those deals. Let me back up though, because the question I have, and this is one of my, I don't know how to answer this. So I'd love to hear your answer. You and I are very blessed and very, very fortunate to have been given opportunities and done well with those opportunities financially. My kids don't have any idea what it's like to need to run away at 17 and start your own life. And they don't have any idea. Like my dad was gone at 11 years old. I saw him like once a year and never went to a basketball game, never really called me. I remember having a check that he wrote me for $100 for like 4 years that bounced. And I just kept it. I kept it in my wallet because I really wanted to cash it. It was from my dad. And finally my stepdad, he's like, hey, it's never gonna clear, buddy. You should just throw it away. So, but that shaped me. That made me very grateful and made me not want to do that to my kids, right? Like I will never put them in that position. But at the same time, how do I teach them the hard lessons in life and not to take what they have for granted because they have so much?
Yeah. So that's a great question, by the way. And it's a big challenge. It's a big concern of mine as well.
Yeah.
My take on that is I say it all the time, probably once a month. I said, hey, nothing is given. Everything's earned in our home. So everything, you know, when my daughter wanted to get her first car, you know, I'll pay 50% of it. She pays the other half of it.
I love that.
It's actually a really interesting story. She actually paid for that car with passive income. You know, a vehicle is a depreciating asset. By the way, if you ask any of my kids, they walked in right now and I said, hey, what's the best type of income? Every one of them knows passive income. They're all competing to see who gets the most amount of passive income. They all have, all four of them, even my nine-year-old, have invested into real estate with me through JVs, joint ventures.
Yeah.
And so, awesome. You know, really trying to teach them at a young age. Also, anytime they read a book on real estate, personal finance, development, I pay them $25 and they have to write a little book report on it. But anyway, the principle is nothing is given, everything is earned. And so, and you know, I think that the truth is, like, I don't think my kids are entitled at all, but at the same time, maybe they know they're a little bit privileged.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that. I think it's okay to then understand, hey, in the real world, you know, I have a lot of privilege right now. But the important thing is that we got to that point through hard work, determination, and a lot of grinding and a lot of sacrifice to get there, right? My wife being so supportive at home, me out on the doors for 15 years. I mean, I spent 100 days on average per year away from home.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of sacrifice that went into that. You know, what's interesting is look at the Rockefeller effect with, you know, just how that generational wealth happens. And generally, you know, if somebody resets a standard, you know, like maybe you and I have for our families, you know, our kids will be fine. It's actually our grandkids that pay the price because they don't get to see the sacrifice and the grind that went into creating that success.
Yep.
And so we do a lot of things to help with that. And one of my favorite things is if we go on a vacation internationally, you know, spend the first day going to a charity or to an orphanage. That. Bring a bunch of toys with us, hand those out. So my kids get to see what the real world looks like.
Yeah.
You know, same thing when we created a foundation, the Allred Family Foundation. So each of my four kids are on the board of directors and they each got to choose their own charitable cause they want to support.
Wow.
And so a percentage of all the money that I pay them in salary, because they're all employees of my real estate, my personal real estate company.
As they should be.
Yep. Great tax deduction as well, right? And so a percentage of that goes automatically into our family foundation. And that's been a really incredible way to be able to teach them about giving back. You know, the more you give, the more you live. And just, you know, it's not, anyway, so we could do a whole podcast on that topic, but I think it's really important. But I think the key there is, you know, getting them in the real world. And I think international travel is such a powerful way to be able to show them culture and what, you know, how many challenges and just how hard life can be for a lot of people.
Let me pause you right there. So I love what you're saying. I have a couple questions. International travel with kids is at one of the top of my list. Do you remember your first day in Peru? And did you go out in Lima? Because you went to the Peru MTC. Do you remember, like, because so they sent us to the Lima North Mission And one of the first people I saw was a dude dying of gangrene in the street with a little girl. And I gave him all my money. Poor people everywhere, people dying, starving. And I just cried. I was just like, what, where the hell am I? What is this place? And I loved Peru. I loved the people that I met there and all my friends. But it was really hard. It was really, really hard to see people struggle. And I gave my money away like every month. Like I was asking my parents, my grandma was sending me money. She had a foundation. Do you remember like how impactful Peru was on you? And as far as, was that your first international travel? Cause that was really hard on me. It was good, but it was eye-opening to say the least.
It was the first international trip. In fact, it was actually the first time I'd been on an airplane.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, I don't remember that much detail. I just remember just being like a fish out of water, and I really didn't know the language very well. And, a companion was a Peruvian guy that, I just remember had very, very bad hygiene.
Yes.
And, you're stuck living together for a couple months. So, I don't remember all too much on that, but I just remember it was really, really challenging. And it was really, really hard.
Yeah. They know real poverty there. They know true poverty. And so I'm all for international travel with kids. Love what you said about the Rockefeller effect.
One thing on the international, kind of a fun, maybe best practice to share with your audience.
Yeah.
So one thing that I do with my family is when my kids turn 15, they get to choose an international trip anywhere in the world they want to go.
Wow.
7 to 14 days. But they've got to do all the research on it, why they want to go there, the culture, the restaurants they want to go to, learn a little bit of the language. And it's been a really fun way to do that. So last year, my daughter wanted to go to, she torn between going to Italy or to France. And after about 2 months of debate on that, when we decided, my favorite model is and not or. So like, hey, let's do both, right? So we went to Venice and Florence and Rome and over to Paris, and it was awesome. My daughter, who's now 15, she wants to go to Japan and South Korea this summer. So we're excited to do that as well. But I think it's a great way to be able to teach kids culture, really open their eyes to just how big the world is and how diverse it is.
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, they get to know what life is like in other countries. They get to see poverty, great, beautiful things as well. And other cultures is really important.
It creates open-mindedness.
Exactly. I love that. So you said something that I want you to explain a little bit. You JV'd with your kids on some deals. So explain to our listeners how you can JV with your kids. So joint venture on a real estate deal. So you buy that real estate deal together, but did they use, their savings, or did you help them invest with, just tell me about that.
Yeah. So probably the best way to explain that is, so my oldest daughter, when she was 14, on her own fruition, she went and got a job. It was actually at one of my first restaurants, Everbowl. She was employee number one, and she was 14 years old. Then she got a job at Riverside Country Club as well. And she's been working really hard, and we were always investing into cryptocurrency, some stock, Lululemon, Nike, whatever that she likes. And then when she was 15 and a half, she's like, hey, I really want to get a car. I'm like, cool, what kind of car do you want? She's like, I want a Tesla Model 3. I'm like, hell no, we're not doing that. That's responsible, right? Yeah. Talked to my insurance agent. He's like, Dave, that's the worst idea possible. 50% of 16-year-olds get in an accident in their first year. But anyway, the bad thing about teaching your kids salesmanship, it's a two-edged sword, right? They know that no means yes. And so it's just relentlessly, just persistent on that. And finally, I realized, a higher quality response is, okay, listen, you have depreciating assets and appreciating assets. A vehicle is a depreciating asset. So if you want to, incur that kind of a liability, you need to figure out how you're going to create enough passive recurring income to pay for that depreciating assets cost.
I love that.
So we did the math on it. Let's say it's, $350 a month for a Model 3 car payment. So I said, okay, listen, so what we can do is we can sell your crypto, we can sell your some of your stocks and whatnot, take your cash you have right now, and we'll JV into a duplex over in Vineyard, Utah. And so she came in. It wasn't a huge allocation, obviously, right? But that investment basically freed up about $300 of reoccurring passive income for her. And so as a result of that, and then I said, hey, on top of that, I'll pay you, whatever amount per hour to help mom Uber the kids around to all these, sports practices and whatnot. Creating a real win-win situation where mom now wins, she wins, she gets the car that she really wants. And so as a result of that, she's making about $400 a month now between driving and her real estate investment. So it more than covers the cost of the vehicle. She has the vehicle she really wants. And then her investment is actually appreciating in the real estate, right? So that nest egg is actually growing while spinning off cash flow to pay for that depreciating asset. So this is an example of like really trying to teach my kids the principles of money, principles of investment. And honestly, man, I love it. It's it's been so fun as a dad to be able to impart that wisdom and teach my kids. You know, it's one of the most fulfilling things for me is awesome. To be able to teach these guys how to win in life. The truth is, like, you know, the public school system, there's no real education around financial literacy and financial management. Simple stuff like compound interest and the federal tax brackets and, I mean,
balancing a checkbook or a bank account.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And that's a whole tangent as to why I think that's the case. But I mean, ultimately, you know, it's free agency, right? That creates free agency. Maybe that's not in the best interest of Big Brother. We'll leave it at that.
No, yeah. And I love the memes, you know, I'm glad I learned the Pythagorean theorem this tax season, you know, help me do my taxes, you know, but it's kind of a joke. But yeah, the public school system teaches the basics. And as a parent, you really need to teach your kids way more than what the public school system teaches them.
And then this is reference to like for my, you know, 9-year-old and my 12-year-old, if they, you know, have $1,000 or, you know, a smaller amount of money to put into it, I call it a JV, but really I'm just paying them, you know, 10-15% cash on cash on their money.
Yeah.
So we still sit down every single month on Sunday, first Sunday of the month, and we go through and we reconcile that. And so they see like how that all works. And it's very, because again, it's all about really just teaching the principle.
Yeah. I love that, man. I just bought my kids all piggy banks, and the 12-year-old said she wants to buy a car. And so, you know, we're talking about how much of your paycheck are you going to put into the savings account for the car? How much are you going to spend? Because right now their answer is they just want to spend and buy toys and buy stuff and buy things. And, you know, this will tell you a little bit how I've operated, but I always put at least 30% of what I made into investments. And I'm not the best at managing my money. I realized that about myself early on in my career. But what I was good at is buying investment properties. And so I would basically make myself poor by putting as much as my money as I could into these investment properties. And so you really have to teach your kids to understand who they are as well. Like, you know, we have six kids between my girlfriend and I, and there's kids that are very disciplined that I think will be great for your approach and, you know, very organized. And there's kids that I'm going to have to be like, hey, you got to invest that money, put it away in that savings account, that investment. We also bought the cash flow game recently, the kids version, and really great teaching tool. So I love everything you're talking about, JVing with your kids, helping them buy investment properties. Passive income is the name of the game, and really understanding the power of money. Because if you get caught up in this consumerism world and you're buying a new iPhone every year, new car every year, outspending what you make, you're never going to have the investments. You're never going to have that passive income. And that's just not taught. It's not taught in public schools. It wasn't taught to me by my parents. Pretty sure my mom just went through her third or fourth bankruptcy. So it's interesting, you know, it's really interesting to me. And I think it's exciting what you're teaching your kids. And I hope our listeners can take a little bit more of this. So that's why I wanted to dive deep into what are you doing with your kids, JVing. You just mentioned you're helping them start businesses as well, which is really cool.
Yeah. And to be a little more technical there. So, you know, if I kind of, I'll call it overpay my kids, you can pay up to $13,000-ish, right, per year per kids. If you have four kids, up to $60,000 a year. Mm-hmm. It's a deduction for the business. And they're below the tax filing threshold.
I'm sorry. We got to break down a little bit slower.
Sure.
For our people that haven't heard of this before, because I've heard of it, I'm familiar with it. So if you have an LLC or a business, you can add your kids on as paid employees for that business.
Yes.
And you can pay them up to $13,000 a year.
Yes.
And that's tax deductible. So that's a really good, some people just see it as, oh, hey, I can save taxes by adding my kids to the payroll. This is so much more than that, because now if you use it as a teaching opportunity and then a JV opportunity and a starting a business opportunity, there's so much more to unpack there than just saving some taxes.
Yeah. I mean, we could go deep on that one, but again, this is not tax advice. I always have to say that, right?
Right. We're not
my attorneys
CPS.
Always want me to make sure I communicate that. But I mean, one of the greatest things is, so as a business owner, like you said, so you can pay up around $13,000 per employee, make sure it's a market rate, right? And there's actually value there. And there's an employee agreement, but how fun is it to take your kids out to do due diligence and your property management? Mm-hmm. Having them involved in the business with you. So it's a really cool learning opportunity there. And then they don't have to file any taxes because it's below the threshold to do so in the United States. Mm-hmm. And then what's even more incredible is then you take that and you put that capital into a Roth IRA, where it's growing tax free. So it's really a triple win on the tax side of things.
You have them self-direct that as well?
Yes.
Yep.
And so, and what I do, Sam, is so let's say you pay your kid, you know, $1,000. So, you know, 10% of it is giving back. 30% is used on whatever they want to, discretion, no questions asked.
Giving back as in charities, right? I love that. That's really important.
Yep. And then 60% is going into investments or education, you know, college education. That's another tangent on college education, but mainly
you pay
it's
them
real
for
estate.
Good grades as well?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. And to read books. So you're paying them to work in these investments. You just broke down your percentages, education, savings, charity. That's huge.
Yep. And right now they're all reading the book, Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad for youth. There's one for kids and one for teens. And so, you know, what I really am excited about right now, currently today, is they're all working on their own businesses. And so my daughter wants to do a 3D printing business. My other daughter already launched her consignment business. My son wants to do a vending machine business for cash flow. And so anyway, that's how fun is that to teach your kids about business when they're, you know, 9, 12, 15 years old. So really, really stoked about that.
I love that, man. That's awesome. So back to kind of our theme for this podcast, it's how you frame life. Your kids have a pretty damn good life. This is awesome what you've created for them. You could have really had a different outcome. You know, you could have been homeless. You could have said, hey, my parents didn't give me the opportunity to win. Instead, you said, here's how I grew up. And here's how I want my kids to grow up. Here's what I want to teach them. And again, being very purposeful and intentional about parenting, which I love. I think that's awesome. I didn't know we were going to get in this today. I knew a little bit. You know, I follow you on social media and know you personally. This is awesome, man. This is really cool.
And it's actually one of my biggest motivators. I've never talked about this on a podcast before, but you know, I feel like every couple of generations or in a family, there's the one person that can, you know, really reset the standard and resolve all those issues and set a new standard, a new standard for what we expect in life, whether that's in success, impact, happiness, you know, family relationships, family culture, so many different things there. But, you know, and again, I say this very humbly because I definitely haven't figured it all out, but it's a work in progress. But, you know, I just really want to be able to create that for my family currently, as well as my future, you know, my posterity. And to me, that's a huge motivator, man. Like, how fun is that? How I feel like there's a lot of fulfillment in that at the end of life. If you can actually say, I've created enormous direct value for those that I really care about the most in my own life.
I love that, man. That's huge. And it's interesting you say that because the last three guests I've had on the podcast, really tough childhood. One addicted to meth at 12, sexual abuse. The other one, sexual abuse at the age of 7. Both wildly successful, great parents. The other one is the girl I'm dating, Betty Jo, homeless, huge amount of abuse, taken away from her mom and put in foster care. And all three of those women have now been wildly successful in business, successful in life, and they've pulled their family up and really affected the lives of their siblings, their parents, their cousins. You know, just Betty Jo, I was interviewing her a couple of weeks ago, and her uncle, her cousin's in business because she got him into landscaping, and she's helped him start his own business. Her brother's a general contractor now because she was flipping houses and she needed help. He's now a very successful general contractor, and you know, this guy's doing this, and so it's very interesting how big of an effect you can have on others.
Brian Peterson, I was just listening to a clip from him. He talks about how there's a lot of new science coming out about how people that have had some trauma in their earlier life, not like a crazy, crazy amount of trauma, but like a decent amount of it, are actually some of the most successful entrepreneurs later in life because they've had to create grit and they've had to become professional problem solvers and really figure out how to navigate those challenges in their lives.
I love that. We're sitting in the office of one of my good friends who at 17 was also out of the home on his own completely, no financial help. And he's a multimillionaire now, created a company that I have no, like one of the smartest guys ever, but he had to figure it out at the age of 17, a lot like you. And I love that. I love that story. So some trauma creates the need for figuring stuff out. And that takes me back to my question with you. Like, what do you do when you've given your kids everything? Well, you've got some really good answers so far. You're teaching your kids as much as you possibly can. The next question I have is, have you had pushback from your kids or one of your kids on all of these systems? I'm guessing they don't love balancing their bank accounts every single Sunday or the first Sunday of every month, or there's got to be part of the system that's harder to implement with your kids. How have you overcome that? And, or do they just buy in because, you know, they see how hard you work?
I say this humbly, but there's not really any pushback. And I'm so grateful for that family culture we have. It's so beautiful. Like I'm so grateful for where relationship is with my wife and my kids right now. It's better than I could have ever imagined. And so
that's awesome.
Mostly I'd say I'm just grateful. And I think it's whatever we're doing is working right now.
That's cool.
Knock on wood. You know, life's kind of crazy sometimes, but it's been great. I'd say the only maybe kind of pushback is, you know, I set up these opportunities for them to start a business or to, you know, work these hours in the business. There's a little bit of a lack of ambition to go and do it because they don't really need to do it, right? Yeah. It's more of a want versus a need. And, you know, satisfied needs don't motivate. And so it's just that's probably the biggest challenge for me is how to really motivate them, incentivize them to do these things that are a little bit harder when they don't actually need to be doing it or really want to be doing it.
Yeah, that's tough.
I don't have an answer for you on how to do it because I'm working through that right now.
It's tough. Yeah, it's absolutely tough. And I'm in a split home, so I have my kids 50% of the time. And, you know, my ex-mother-in-law is extremely wealthy and giving, and all her kids got a brand new car, whatever they wanted at 16. And so I know my kids are expecting that. And I mean, not just my ex, but we spoil our kids a lot. And so I'm working through that as well. The best example, and this is quite extreme, but one of my early brokers in Pleasant Grove, John Haar, I think he had it figured out. And his vacation budget was $100,000 a year. They did service everywhere they went. They did service here in Utah. He would not buy them a car. He helped them start a business so they could buy a car. He wouldn't buy them clothing. He'd buy his daughter's dresses for the school dances. He'd help them do fun stuff. But clothing, if they wanted nice clothes, if they wanted a nice car, all of those things they had to pay for themselves, but he'd help them start a business. So he'd create the need by not buying them the clothing or the cars or the different things they wanted. He'd take them on amazing vacations, show them all the whole world, but did a really good job of creating the need. And he was a mentor of mine, and I think he did a really great job of that. It's hard, though. It's hard as a parent to do that.
Yeah. So on that note, made me think of something. So my 15-year-old now, she also wants a Tesla Model 3 like her older sister has. And so actually last night I sat down with her, okay, did the math on this one. Your passive income is this, you know, this is the gap. It's still pretty substantial between your, you know, passive income versus the lease payment. And so literally right now, my executive assistant is with her at University Mall looking to expand her consignment business into a new location at the mall.
Awesome.
And so like that's the exact same thing. Like, hey, we're not going to buy this depreciating asset for you. It was going to create a liability for you. So you have to figure out how to get enough passive income. So literally it's funny you mentioned that though, because they're literally there right now working on that. So
that's awesome.
Let's go.
Congrats, dude. I'm really inspired, and I hope our listeners are well, I know they will be, to hear how much effort you're putting in. Because as a parent, there's a lot that you have to do. You have to help with homework. You have a house to manage.
And you have, you know, multiple businesses on top of that.
You're it's not like you're a stay at home dad. I mean, or you've got a lot going on. And so, that's the type of parent I think a lot of people want to be like. That's the type of parent I want to be like, putting in the extra effort, taking the time. You bought a fourplex in Boise from me. My daughter was 3 at the time. And she was on those business trips. I drove her to Boise with me. She was in those meetings with the city. She was on her iPad, you know, but I made her take notes when she started to write. She was always on appointments with me. My son hasn't been as much. But, you know, it's hard to take a 3-year-old to Boise. But I wanted her to spend time with her dad, and I wanted her to see what I do from a very early age. And I'll take her on appointments. I still sell houses here in Utah. And I'll have her write down, why should they buy this house? What do you think needs to be fixed in this house, Heidi? She's 10 now, and she does a killer job. I'm hoping she gets a real estate license at 18 and makes $1 million a year. I bet she will. But it's extra effort.
Yeah, no, it really is. And you know, you kind of let off this conversation talking about intentionality. To me, my whole life's been intention. I mean, my whole adult life has been really focused on intentionality, and it's getting crystal clear on what you define as winning in the end game, Like at the end of your life, what do you really want? You know, what are you going to feel like you don't have any regrets around? And so I think that, you know, I challenge people to do this, but really spend the time to get crystal clear on what it is you really want in your life. Like what's your definition of winning? And there's no right or wrong answer. And it's very unique to each individual. But the clarity you can get on that, then it becomes fun because then you can just simply reverse engineer. I love that word. Yep. Reverse engineer, right? So get clear on the end goal. Reverse engineer what actions and habits you need to be doing on a daily basis to make sure you're in alignment and congruency to be on track to hit that end goal. And I feel like that's where true fulfillment and happiness comes from, is when you know why you're doing what you're doing, right? And more so who you are versus what you do, mm-hmm. right? So it's who, not what. And so it's not easy to figure that out, but I promise it's worthwhile. And it's probably the best time I've ever spent in my life, is really getting clear on how do I define a life well-lived with purpose, impact, happiness, and having no regrets in my life. And, you just kind of step backwards from that. Most people go through life meandering based on their motivation level or putting out fires or whatever's exciting to them, versus really making sure it's in line with what they want to create in their life.
I love that. One of my favorite speakers was Zig Ziglar. Lots of great quotes from him. But
all-time favorite quote in my life, Zig Ziglar: "You can have everything you want in your life if you open up other people to what they want."
That's my all-time favorite quote as well. I quoted that at the event last 2 weeks ago. "You can have anything you want in life if you help enough other people get what they want." His other quote was, he defined happiness as the pursuit of a worthwhile goal or objective. It's not obtaining that goal or objective. It's not making the $1 million. It's not, buying the dream car. It's the excitement and the pursuit of something worthwhile. And I think teaching kids that is really important, because everyone wants to have the thing. And that's why when they get the thing for free without the work or the effort, they're not happy. You know, kids just want, they'll endlessly chase that next thing that you can give them. Whereas if you teach them to work and push towards it, that's happiness. They're excited. And I can't tell you how much excitement I get from my goals. And this goes a little bit personal with me, but during the divorce, I didn't have goals. My goal was to get 50% custody minimum and to have my kids affected as little as possible by that divorce. Financially, and all those things, didn't have a lot of goals. And with my business coach, after a couple of years, he's like, "Sam, do you have any goals?" I'm like, "Man, I kind of took a break there for a while." And my happiness has improved a ton as I reset my goals, and realizing that I need to do that for my kids as well, and setting goals for them this summer. They're all starting businesses this summer. I don't care if it's mowing lawns or selling lemonade, but they're going to have businesses this summer. And so back to Zig Ziglar, and you can have anything you want in life if you help enough other people. And happiness is the pursuit of a worthwhile goal or objective.
And speaking of, the end goal and getting clarity and help your kids with goal setting, I've created something called lifestyle design. It could be a whole podcast, but it's basically the 10 areas in my life that I want to be great at, right? It's my purpose statement, my core values, my time, my energy, my health, my finances, my business, spiritual, personal development, and relationships. And so I've created this template with 10 sections to it, and it's all written out exactly how I define winning in each one of those 10 different categories. And I share with a lot of people now, and so I decided to put it on my website. And if any of your listeners want to download a free copy of that.
Oh, I love that.
It's website's daveallred.com.
Really put the link in the notes for sure.
Pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
And there's a download there. And then this summer, I actually created a youth lifestyle design. And so it's just kind of a watered down version of that, a little more simple.
Yeah.
And so this last summer, I had all my kids go through that, all 10 sections. And how cool is that to be able, as a dad, to have your kids basically identify the best version of themselves and what they want to accomplish in all 10 of those categories? Mm-hmm. And it's all in writing, right? So the goal is every year I'm going to go back and revise those. So it's a living document. But anyway, I just want to share that.
That's
actually a download as well on my website if any of your listeners want to get a copy of that.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll actually email it out. We have a lot of subscribers, listeners that love stuff like that. I'll send it out. I really appreciate that. So what it is 10 areas of life that you can set goals in. And again, being purposeful and deliberate about how you create your life. And I think that's great. And I think most people in general don't even think about that. I have employees that I know 100% do not have goals in life.
Most people spend more time planning out their annual vacation than they do their actual life.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yep. They can sit down and plan this vacation and get excited about it. And I think that's a really good example though. If you can think about planning a vacation and how fun that is, and if you can translate that into your financial life, you can translate that into your health and fitness goals, translate that into being a parent. How do you want your kid to turn out? We've had a few people on the podcast that have been really inspiring. Hal Swayze, when he has two boys, when they're in middle school, he didn't feel like he was really meeting his own expectations for himself as a dad. And something that he really wanted to do was travel the world with his boys. He took them out of school. They were both in middle school for a whole year and he traveled the world. And he said, I'm going to give them an education that the public school system will never give them. They did book reports. They did service projects. They did literally anywhere they wanted to travel, he took them. And he said, is the single best thing he did ever as a dad. And I've had three other friends do that since then, since they heard his story. And I think that's amazing. You know, again, being very, very deliberate about what he wanted to do, the time he wanted to spend, the lessons he wanted to teach his boys was huge. So anyways, we've got a lot to cover. We probably need to do a few more podcast episodes because we've got so much to talk about. We've talked about lifestyle design, which thank you for the free download. We'll send the notes out with your website. We talked about you left the home at 17. Since then, you're self-made millionaire by the age 26. By the way, actually, I didn't mention that. So self-made millionaire by the time you're 26. Did you do that just through sales or sales and investing?
That was mainly through sales. I'd acquired a few rental properties at that point, but that was mainly through sales.
Okay. That's awesome. So by 26, over $1 million net worth, and mostly through Apex Sales, Vivint Sales. Now, tell me about buying your multifamily and your investment properties, because I know the story and I've heard it a couple times briefly, but you bought a fourplex and now you have 62 units. And the coolest part about this story that I want people to think about, and this is the power of appreciation in real estate. You put money into fourplex. It turned into 62 units without investing any more dollars, any more of your own earned income, just by appreciation. So tell me about that story. I know we don't have a lot of time, but let's get a few nuggets out of that because
I'll go fast on it. So I'm out knocking doors and I'm like, hey, why am I doing this? Like I need like a more of a purpose, right? And I put a lot of time into self-reflection and try to figure out why I was doing what I was doing. And ultimately it came down to freedom. And I realized, you know, luckily at an early age, one of my core motivators for Dave Allred is freedom. I want a lot of freedom to be doing what I want to be doing with the people I want to be doing it when I want to be doing it, and really to create, you know, financial freedom. And by the way, the focus was financial freedom, but then after achieving that, it really turned more to focusing on time freedom, which is the most important resource. Mm-hmm. And then having achieved that, then it really turned more so to lifestyle freedom. So it's kind of like an evolution from financial freedom to time freedom to lifestyle freedom. But the, you know, so I'm out knocking doors. I'm like, you know, why am I doing this? Like, freedom. So I sat down, I've been talking about financial freedom for a long time. I was 30 years old. I'm like, okay, you know, there's a big difference between wanting something and being committed to it. So I sat down on a Sunday for 4 hours, pulled up a spreadsheet, and I just figured out how much passive income I actually needed to be able to create this financial freedom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically it came down to I need to have 40 rental properties and I gave myself 10 years to achieve that. And so the goal became 40 by 40. And I changed all my passwords to 40 by 40, became my mantra. Every Sunday I'd sit down and reflect back on my progress there. And I really hit that goal when I was 36 years old. And then I upped that to ownership in 1,000 doors by age 40, you know, hit that goal. And then I decided to launch, I did a bunch of syndications, multifamily, large ones across the country, helped bring the Topgolf into Utah County here. And then decided to launch Axie Partners, the real estate firm with a fund structure. And so anyway, backing up. So my very first acquisitions, I bought 4 townhomes from the court steps. It was actually short sales.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, luckily I had the cash from, you know, making good money doing door sales. So about $100,000 per townhome. So $400,000 of cash went into it. About 2 years later, those had appreciated to being worth about $200,000 per townhome.
Wow.
Okay, that's when I met you and the team.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with the fourplex model.
Yep.
And so I 1031 exchanged each one of those townhomes into a brand new fourplex. Okay, so I went from four doors to now having 12 doors.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's new developments. There's, you know, 100,000 or so of equity built in day one, which is nice. And so about 2 to 3 years later, I had probably closer to $400,000 to $500,000 of equity in each of those, right? The $200,000 I put into it plus the natural appreciation. And by the way, the market's been really, really hot during this whole story. And so so there's a lot of tailwind behind this, but at the same time, the principles still apply. And so 3 years later, I was able to take those four fourplexes and 1031 exchange each one of those into two fourplexes, right? So now I went up to having a total of eight fourplexes.
Mm-hmm.
A few years later, same thing. I took each fourplex and 1031 exchange up into 2 to 3 new ones. So, you know, in Arizona, in Vineyard, in kind of all over the place, Magna, Boise, Meridian, and Napa, right? So I bought, you know, 2 to 4 fourplexes in each one of those markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so long story short, I literally went from those first four units all the way to 62 units through 1031 exchanging those and with no additional cash out of pocket.
That's now,
I was still buying real estate on the side, right? It's kind of independent of this.
Mm-hmm.
But guys, such an incredible way to be able to scale a portfolio without having to put a lot more money into it.
Yeah.
And so I share that. And one thing that I learned about 5 years into my real estate investing journey is most investors, including myself, we always pay attention to cash on cash returns, right? Mm-hmm. That's what's fun, right?
Yeah.
And generally those will be going up, you know, 1-2% per year with inflation. So it looks like you're doing awesome, right? You got more cash flow coming in. In my opinion, if you want to aggressively grow your portfolio, the more important metric is actually cash on equity, right? And so your cash on equity is actually going down the longer you hold the asset. The reason why is because every month you're paying down the principal reduction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then also you have natural market appreciation. And so your cash on equity is going down while your cash on cash is going up. So, which is fine. But if you want to actually scale and grow, like what worked for me was as soon as that cash on equity drops below 4 to 5%, I'm going to look at that and do either a cash out refinance or a 1031 exchange, parlay that equity into a bigger asset. Because I call it the velocity of money. But there's five ways to make money in real estate, right? One is cash flow, my favorite. Number two is natural market appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is depreciation, all the tax benefits. Number four is principal reduction, naturally through the mortgage. And number five is leverage.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I found is, you know, a fourplex, you know, you have cash flow, appreciation, principal pay down, and leverage. But when you can scale that up with more units, all five of those wealth drivers are better.
Yep.
Right? And so that's one thing I think a lot of people don't really understand about real estate is there's really five ways to make money. It's not just the cash flow. And so the faster you can control, one of my goals is basically to control as much real estate as possible that's cash flow positive.
I love that.
Because naturally you're going to build a lot of wealth through the natural appreciation,
mm-hmm.
the tax benefits, which by the way, tax benefits are incredible. Some people don't understand
amazing.
Just how powerful that is, right?
Yep.
Because if you can save money on paying taxes, but use that money to go and deploy that to buy more real estate,
mm-hmm.
it's this flywheel effect
yep.
and just compounds with time.
Yeah, that really good explanation. Thank you for that. And I think all of the smart, sophisticated investors and the experienced investors realize very quickly what I call the law of diminishing returns. If you have all this equity built into this property from either forcing the appreciation, like you and I buy multifamily deals, we fix it up, we force the appreciation, or by the market appreciating, or by your renters paying down the principal, it's not doing anything for you until you redeploy, cash out, refi, or sell and 1031 into something else. And so I love that story. 4 units to 62 units. You invested $400,000 originally and parlayed that into a 62 unit. That's huge. That's an amazing story. And that's the ultimate success story in real estate, taking advantage of a really good situation and not just stopping. There's people that want to stop. And I always have investors that say, well, I just want to buy a couple of properties and pay them off. And my goal is never to convince them to not do that, but to teach them the lesson that you just gave us, which is there's 5 ways to earn money. And if you pay off a property and just keep it, you're really selling yourself short and you're going to earn so much less than what you could have.
You know, I paid all cash for those first four purchases because I was always taught debt is bad.
Yeah.
You know, it hurts your free agencies.
Dave Ramsey teaches that.
My parents always said it, right? Fast forward to today, guys, I love debt, but
good debt.
So the definition to me, and I mean, it's close to $100 million of debt right now in commercial real estate. And my definition of good debt is fixed, low interest that creates positive cash flow. It's that simple, right? So fixed low interest rate that creates positive, consistent, positive cash flow.
Yep.
I want as much of that as I can possibly get.
Absolutely.
Especially in a high inflationary environment like we're in today.
Yeah. We're actually looking at a deal that probably this week I'll send to you guys. It's next to a property that we have 10-year debt on at 3%. We bought it at, for $14 million. It's now worth $22 million. We will eventually refi or sell that property. But the property we're looking at has fixed just over 4% debt, 6 more years on the loan, and they're struggling to manage it. It's 150 units in Dallas. And I mean, what an amazing asset. That's basically what we own. We own, we have similarly about $100 million in debt right now. And we love it. We love fixed mortgages, and the rents are going up. When we bought the property there in Dallas, rents were $113,000 gross per month. They're now $160,000. And so fixed debt is amazing. I actually went viral on TikTok for saying something that's a little bit rude, but I said, Dave Ramsey's an idiot. What I should have said is Dave Ramsey teaches to not use debt, and you can use debt in a very smart way. So good debt is just like you said, it cash flows, it's fixed, it's long-term, and it creates wealth. And so all of the sophisticated, smart investors I know use debt to their advantage. And that's how you can grow as fast as you can. If you hadn't used debt, you'd probably be at 8, 10, 12 units right now instead of 62. So,
yep, 100%. By the way, Dallas is a great market. Probably one of my top three in the country right now still.
Love Dallas.
Yeah, Dave Ramsey, it's fun. I actually me and my partner troll him a little bit on social media as well. My take on him is to be a little outdated. A lot of his stuff is very, you know, it's from the, you know, back in the generations where went through great recessions and it's all about hiding cash underneath your mattress, right?
Yeah.
It's just very, very antiquated and just not very up to today's terms. You think about it, debt. I mean, every S&P 500 company, they have a ton of debt,
ton of
leverage,
debt.
Right? That's the modern economy today is orientated around debt and leverage. It really is. So you can play without it, but it's going to be a much longer game.
Here's the type of people Dave Ramsey's really good for. People that need to learn
basics.
They need to learn self-control. And that's really what he's teaching. I really don't think Dave doesn't understand debt, good debt. I think what he teaches is if you don't have self-control, I got to do something to help you not die poor. And so I'm going to teach you to not use debt because credit cards are bad. Buying expensive cars, depreciating assets is bad. I think he does a really good job for the people that really need to learn the low basics of how do I not spend myself into the poorhouse?
Yeah.
That's what he teaches people. But to become a wealthy investor like yourself, cash flowing, you know, a lot every year. I don't know what your cash flow is, but cash flowing thousands every year and every month, you have to use debt. So Dave, this has been amazing. We got to wrap up here, but I think we're going to have you on again soon. I'm really excited about Axia and what you're doing over there with your partners. I'm really excited about you're raising $75 million starting. When are you starting the raise for that?
We're launching our next fund here in about 2 months out.
Okay. Now. Okay. So we're recording this in end of April. So that'll be about July. And that'll be a 506C offering. So you have to be an accredited investor, which most of mine are as well. And a really cool thing that you're also doing is a Reg A offering, which is your goal in helping out the smaller investors who aren't accredited yet. And accredited means you make $200,000, $300,000 a year, depending on if you're solo or with a partner. And I don't know, that's really exciting to me. So tell me a little bit about this fund. You're going to obviously be looking into commercial real estate, but tell me a little bit about what your investment thesis is for that fund and also why you added the Reg A offering.
Yeah, you bet. So this will be our fifth offering. So we launched about three and a half years ago as a firm. I'm really proud of what we built, about 400 or so different investors in the fund right now, in our funds. And on this offering, what we're going to be focusing on is value-add multifamily across the nation, and which is pretty traditional down the middle of the fairway. But we're also adding a new component to this because of all the cracks in the market right now. There's a lot of distress out there. And so to capitalize on that, we're adding a distressed multi-asset component as well. So it's basically a core and a satellite. So the core of the fund is heavy value add multifamily. And then the satellite of that is distressed. And when we say distressed, it's actually foreclosures and short sales. And so my team and two of my partners have an extensive background in the 2008, 2009, 2010, you know, housing collapse, working with foreclosures and short sales, like true distressed properties. And so we're gonna really focus in on that. We have some AI as well that will help us with the underwriting and finding these opportunities. And so, you know, I feel like there's such a huge opportunity right now, and especially going into the second half of this year around the distressed marketplace. And so that's the way we can really create, you know, outsized returns by capitalizing on that distress in the market right now.
I love that.
And so that's the approach on it. The 506C, you know, it's very, you know, very standard. The Reg A is a lot of people aren't very familiar with what that is, but basically it allows us to publicly solicit, and we can allow non-accredited investors in at a much smaller investment minimum, right? So you know, most likely we'll have that around, you know, $10,000 as a minimum, versus, you know, our larger funds are always $100,000 minimum investment. So it really just opens it up to a much wider net of investors, and it allows people to come in that aren't accredited. And, you know, frankly speaking, I understand why, you know, they have the accredited, you know, the thought process is it protects smaller investors that maybe don't know what they're doing, right?
Less educated, yeah.
That's right. But frankly speaking, it's not a great measurement. I mean,
it's
I know
an
some
antiquated
guys,
law.
I know some guys that are multimillionaires. They had a business exit. They know nothing about financial literacy, how the tax code works, any of that. So, you know, I do think it's not, the intention is good behind that, but it's it is a little antiquated. So anyway, that's what we're going to be doing as our next offerings. And, you know, I'd say what we really, our strong value proposition is what we call experiential investing. So you go to our homepage on the main homepage, it says experiential investing. And I'm really proud of that. It's a term I coined about 3 years ago, and it's a full commitment to transparency and teaching how we do what we do. So instead of just focusing on an ROI, return on investment, it's also an ROE, a return on experience. And so every month we do an educational webinar. We have some of the top guys in the country coming on and just teaching for 45 minutes in a Q&A session. Every time we close on a deal, we do a full 1 hour webinar. We show how we found the deal, the underwriting, how we source the debt, just full transparency to teach how we do what we do.
I love that.
You know, I've never seen another investment firm that is so committed to the education and transparency, and it's been received very well. And
I can give you one that has seen a huge amount of success because of exactly what you're talking about. And I haven't paid as much attention. I'm going to look at a lot more into what you're doing because that's huge. And Grant Cardone breaks deals down for the common person, right? Like that's what he did so well. And he's got billions in assets now. So I'm really excited to hear that about you guys. And I think sounds like you do even way more than Grant, breaking down the deal, how you found it, how you analyzed it, how you took the deal down, what the business plan is. There's so many investors that will eat that up, and I'm sure they already are. And so hats off to you for really creating something that most investors will never see. I did a weekly podcast for years just about the deals that we were buying and analyzing, but never went as far as it sounds like you are. And I think that's great. That's awesome.
What prompted that for me was, you know, I was a 16-year leadership career managing, you know, thousands of sales reps across the country. And I really love that interpersonal development of helping young people, leading them and seeing them develop. And then I moved over to full-time real estate, and I'm sitting in my office looking at spreadsheets and, you know, the MLS all day long. And I really miss that human aspect of it.
Love
and
that.
So I was saying, hey, how can I, you know, kind of add that leadership aspect and the human aspect to real estate? And that's really what was kind of the origin story behind creating experiential investing.
I love that, man. That's awesome. That's really cool. Well, lots of really good takeaways from the podcast today. Dave, thank you so much for your time, for what you've shared. My key highlight, I mean, I always go back to being a dad. It's what I love. It's what I live for. from a very early age. I wanted to be a really good dad. And I really appreciate what you're doing for your kids and what you're now sharing with the public. You're making it free on your website, designing a life. And so, you know, when I think Dave Allred and Axia Partners, but most importantly, Dave Allred, I think life by design, and being very purposeful and intentional with what you do as a dad, as a real estate investor. I remember your spreadsheets. They're extremely detail oriented. And that's great. That's really important. People need to learn more how to do that. And also on the business side, being transparent and helping the people that are investing with you, I think is unique. And it's why you guys have seen so much success so quickly. And just so our listeners know a little bit more about Axia, you guys exploded. I mean, you're being modest. So you guys exploded onto the scene. I've raised a good amount of money in the syndication space. You guys have raised a crazy amount of money. And, you know, there's reasons why people see success, and there's reasons why people invest with you guys and why you've been so successful. It's all everything we've talked about today. And I know people have invested with you, and I just want to say congrats on your success. Keep doing what you're doing because it's working. And you and I have the same thesis. This year, we're looking for distressed assets. And just a reminder to those that are nervous about investing in this market, I know there's a lot of people really nervous. The most millionaires are made in down markets. And what you and I are looking for this year is opportunity, the opportunity fund, the opportunity to cash in a market that's unstable and not secure, but where there's huge amount of value to be made.
I could not agree more. You look at the statistics over the last 30 years, all the top performing funds and operators have been those that launched during times of distress and economic recession. So people ask me all the time, like, hey man, how do you feel about the market right now? The news, the headlines. My honest answer is, I'm excited. Like, yeah, this is an incredible opportunity in front of us. And yeah, you got to be cautious. You got to be careful. You need to make sure you know what you're doing. Watch out for the landmines along the way. But this next 12 months, I think, is going to provide some of the most incredible, in hindsight, some of the most incredible buying opportunities we'll see in the United States housing market.
I agree full-heartedly, and I'm excited to see what you guys do. I'm excited to see what we can find. To end the podcast, I want to remind people, it's all about how you frame things. That was my takeaway, the golden nugget today. It's how you framed going out of the home at 17 and creating your own life. It's how you frame what happens to you and what you do with your opportunity or what you do with your trials and tribulations. And I really appreciate you talking about that today and everything you said. So thanks, Dave. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to the Get Leveraged podcast with Sam Newell. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share this episode with the person who needs to hear it most. Tune in next week for another incredible conversation. We'll see you there.